I call the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. I'll note for the record that we do have a quorum. With that, we will move to three sets of minutes to approve. The first set of minutes is the regular minutes from March 25th from our joint, and the second set of minutes is from our joint committee on Regents. And last, we have several minutes that we talked about last time. There were two sets of minutes that mistakenly left off Representative Claiborne. And we, as we adopted that, we actually realized that we had added Bliss, who was from, before we were all official, we had Bliss on this committee. So we'll talk about that in a minute. First, we're going to approve the minutes from March 25th. And Representative Scott?
I will move the minutes from March 25th, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Scott moves the minutes of the approval of the minutes from March 25th. Any discussion? Is everybody on the March 25th minutes? Very good. Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The minutes are approved. Next set of minutes. So the next set of minutes is from our Joint Committee on Regents. And Representative Scott, have you had an opportunity to review those minutes? I know they're long.
Yes, Madam Chair, I did review those. I'm sorry that we did have to have a joint committee meeting with the Senate, but I approve the minutes.
So noted. Thank you, Chair Scott. So Representative Scott moves the minutes from the joint committee from March 18th. Any discussion? And I will note that I looked through them thoroughly and made sure that all of the names and the votes were correct, as did Chair Wolgamont, and I believe our staff as well. I think we've had four or five sets of eyes on these because they are very important. Any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from the joint committee, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Minutes are approved. Okay. Lastly, you have a set of minutes in your packets. And last committee hearing, we realized that, unfortunately, Representative Claiborne had been left off of those two sets of minutes from March 13th and March 20th. And we had put on Representative Bliss, who was here before we were official with the Democrat colleagues that we have. So we had a mistake on those two. We also had found three more sets of minutes that February 25th, February 27th, and March 11th, which all have been corrected, and that entire set of 5 minutes are now in your packets. And they are all now, including Representative Claiborne. Thank you for her eagle eye of seeing that she was a part of the 13th and the 20th minutes, and Representative Bliss has been removed. And I have thoroughly gone through those minutes, again, to make sure nothing else was askew. So I will move those, or actually I will do a motion to reconsider the approval of those minutes, because we're going to need to bring them up and then discuss them. So I would entertain a motion to reconsider those set of minutes. Representative Allen.
I'd make that motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Allen makes the motion to reconsider the approval of the minutes from February 25th, 27th, March 11th, March 13th, and March 20th. Any discussion to those minutes? Everyone's names are correctly on there, I believe. Everyone look for your own name. Representative Scott.
I would have to check my calendar, but it says that I was an excused member on February 25th. I think the only day I've missed of this legislative session was on a Monday, and we don't meet on Monday. So I'm wondering if I wasn't here on the 25th, but I can check, because if I was here for my own committee, then there's a good chance I was here for this one too.
Okay. We are going to double check. Thank you for your eagle eye in those minutes. Representative Scott.
And Madam Chair, I realize that sometimes I am a little bit tardy getting to the committee, so it could have been something like that. So.
Duly noted, Representative Scott. We are looking right now. Any other discussion to the set of 5 minutes that we are now are before us? Representative Liebling.
I wonder if Representative Scott was also was excused actually on the 27th, February 27th.
So while Representative Scott is looking to see which day she was excused from Representative Hicks. I know that you were excused on a day where you were doing some adoption work, Representative Hicks. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe I was here. I mean, according to my, I had a lot of stuff on my calendar that day. It's probably just that I was late.
Okay, so we will incorporate that change. And tell me again which day that was. Was that February 27th?
February 25th and 27th.
Okay. Representative Claiborne.
If I could just add a moment of levity, please. I would just like the committee to acknowledge the great working relationship between the judiciary co-chairs. I just say. Did you watch State Gov this morning?
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. Yes, we have wonderful chairs from judiciary. Both chairs are here, so that is also very important. So we are going to make that, we're going to incorporate that change, Representative Scott, for those 2 days that you will be present. Which day? There's two. Okay. So. Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. Seeing none. We are now going to move to the approval of this set of minutes with incorporating the change from Representative Scott from February 25th and February 27th, moving her from members excused to members present. Last call for any other discussion, anything else that you see? Okay, seeing none. So we'll move to the approval of the minutes with those incorporated changes from February 25th, February 27th, March 11th, March 13th, and March 20th. All in favor of the approval of the minutes as a block, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say nay. Those slate of minutes are approved. Okay. Thank you all for your patience and your grace. Most importantly, now we'll move to the Office of Higher Education, and they're going to finish their presentation on the state grant and North Star Promise programs. And we'll welcome back to the committee our wonderful Commissioner Olson and his staff and his team. Welcome, Commissioner Olson. Please state your name for the record and delight us with your testimony and your slide presentation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dennis Olson. I serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And thank you, Madam Chair and members, for having us back to hopefully wrap this up. I see we do have ample time, and I believe have 8 slides, including the title slide you see up in front of you, and a question slide. So really 6 with content I think we'll be able to get through. But again, just appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you. At this point, I'll hand it off to Ms. Schneider.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Schneider, and I serve as the Research Director for the Office of Higher Education. So 2 weeks ago, we went through the first part of this presentation that was focused on the state grant program. And because the state grant program interrelates with the North Star Promise program, we're just going to focus on the North Star Promise program in these last few slides of our full presentation. I have a note here that says the information on this slide corresponds to line 7 on your condensed budget sheet, so hopefully that's still accurate. For the North Star Promise program, the appropriation for fiscal year 25 was $117 million. However, $5 million in North Star Promise funds were transferred to cover costs for the Fostering Independence Higher Education Grant Program, bringing the base resources for the program down to $112 million for fiscal year 25. The ongoing appropriation for the North Star Promise program is $49.5 million. And the North Star Promise program has two components to it. The first is what we refer to as the North Star Promise Base Award, and then the second is the North Star Promise Plus Award. And these were established in 2023 with awards to students starting in the fall of 2024, so just this past fall. The North Star Promise Base is a last dollar scholarship program that covers up to 100% of tuition and fees after gift aid is deducted. For the purposes of the North Star Promise program, gift aid is financial aid that does not have to be paid back, and it does not include aid that is specifically designated for other expenses, such as housing or childcare. Also, just a note, a last dollar scholarship program is a scholarship that is paid after all other gift aid is applied to a student's tuition and fees. This program is available to Minnesotans who are attending a public post-secondary institution or a tribal college in the state, who completed a FAFSA or the Minnesota State Aid application. They have an adjusted gross income of less than $80,000. They're a high school graduate or equivalent. They have not earned a baccalaureate degree. They're not in student loan default or more than 30 days behind on child support, and they meet satisfactory academic progress according to the institution's policy, which typically includes meeting GPA requirements and a measure of pace or progress towards completion of their certificate or diploma or degree. The North Star Plus, North Star Promise Plus, is an additional award for students with the greatest financial need, and it's only available if funds remain after scholarships are awarded for the North Star Promise Base program. It's available in fiscal year 25, 26, and 27. It's awarded to eligible students in an amount up to 50% of the amount of a Pell Grant a student would receive. For fiscal year 25, the North Star Promise Plus awards are calculated as 15% of the student's Pell. The NSP Plus funds can be used to cover additional components of the cost of attendance beyond tuition and fees. So this can include things like books and supplies. So it goes beyond tuition and fees. The information on this slide might be different, what you had, different from the slide that we had in our original presentation, because I updated the numbers earlier this week, and I think you should have the printed copy. Okay. So as I mentioned, fall of 24 is the first term that the NSP base and NSP Plus awards were made to students. So in the fall of 24, institutions reported spending $27.26 million on the North Star Promise base and then $19.16 million on North Star Promise Plus for a total of $46.42 million so far for fall of 24. There were 15,146 North Star Promise Base Awards and 44,639 North Star Promise Plus Awards paid to students. The total unique count of students receiving North Star Promise funding, so that's either the Base or the Plus, for fall was 50,466. About 9,000 received both the North Star Promise and North Star Promise Plus in the fall. The average award for the North Star Promise Base was $1,800, and the average award for the North Star Promise Plus was $429. So this slide has a table showing the spending projections for fiscal year 24 and 25 for the North Star Promise program, and these were included in the state grant February 25 projections. The program first started awarding scholarships to students in fiscal year 25, so that's why the costs for the program for fiscal year 24 are $0 in this table. As I mentioned, for the state grant projections, we not only project spending based on a model, but we also look at current disbursements from the program to get an idea of where spending will ultimately settle for the fiscal year. So as of a few days ago, earlier this week, North Star Promise had disbursed about $54 million in North Star Promise base awards, $33 million in North Star Promise Plus awards, for a preliminary total of $87 million so far for this year. So that's fall and then partial spring. So based on this level of spending to date, coupled with the decreases to the state grant program for spring and the elimination of state grant summer 2025 awards, those were two things that are going to decrease state grant spending, but will simultaneously increase North Star spending. We anticipate the actual spending for the program will be close to the projected total spending of $105.382 million for the fiscal year. So this leaves a roughly $6.8 million balance in the special revenue account that can be carried forward to the next biennium. So this slide has a table showing the spending projections for North Star Promise for fiscal year 26 and 27, and these are also included in the state grant projections report from February. If we focus first on fiscal year 26, you'll see the $6.8 million balance in the special revenue account carried forward from fiscal year 25, plus the appropriation of $49.5 million for a total of $56.304 million in resources for fiscal year 26. Because resources are not projected to be available to fund the North Star Promise Plus component, we are anticipating the North Star Promise Plus match for fiscal year 26 to be 0%. And if you remember from our presentation about 2 weeks ago, we shared information about projections for state grant spending for fiscal year 26. And initially, our projections for fiscal year 26 for state grant projected a deficit for the program. And so because of this, our office issued estimated state grant parameters for fiscal year 26, or in other words, we rationed awards in order to decrease state grant spending. So that decrease in projected state grant spending is putting a strain on the North Star Promise resources for fiscal year 26, because again, the two programs are interrelated and a change in state grant spending will impact North Star Promise spending. So we are projecting a deficit for the North Star Promise program for fiscal year 26 of $7.346 million. If we focus on fiscal year 26, the story is a little different because in fiscal year 26, state grant parameters revert back to what's in statute. So in other words, there's no rationing applied to those numbers. And we're projecting a $136.438 million deficit for the state grant in fiscal year 27. So because state grant spending is projected to increase in fiscal year 27, spending for North Star Promise is simultaneously projected to decrease in fiscal year 27. To $37.351 million. But even with the reduced North Star Promise spending, we anticipate that there will not be enough resources to fund the North Star Promise Plus awards in fiscal year 27. And then two things to note. These projections for fiscal year 26 and 27 do not include the structural changes referenced in the governor's proposal for the state grant. When we do the projections, we base it on what's currently estimated or what's currently set in law. And then another note on this is our office's ability to project the North Star spending is going to improve after we have a full year of North Star Promise data, as well as information on the other gift aid that students receive when they receive the North Star Promise. So we anticipate that these numbers will become more accurate as our projections continue going forward.
Okay. Commissioner Olson, do you have more?
A couple more.
I thought I saw a question, so I was just pausing.
Great. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. So I just wanted to make sure I'm following the situation of the deficit in 2026 relative to the state grant program. So what I heard you say is that because the state grant program is in trouble and has a deficit, and I understand how that interacts with North Star, that is hitting in 2026. But something resets, and so it doesn't apply in 2027. So is that just like a projection situation? Because the deficit will continue to exist. So I'm assuming, unless we totally solve the state grant deficit this session, it will persist into the future. So what is the interaction there?
Ms. Schneider.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. sorry, I have to wrap my head around this for a minute.
So it seems like
Representative Robbins.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It seems like you said that the deficit for 2026 acknowledges the problem in the state grant program, but something resets so that you're back to surplus in 2027. What is that thing? Is it something in statute? Is it something in how the projections are run? What is that?
Yep.
Ms. Schneider.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. It's for the projections. So when we do the projections for fiscal year 27, we run them based on what the parameters are in law as of that date. And so right now in law, we have to use what is in Minnesota Statute 136A. But I'm not sure what exactly the reset.
Ms. Schneider, I'm going to help you out here.
Okay, thank you.
So what happens is that they have different levers that they can pull to do rationing. And they pulled those levers and thereby reduced the grant awards because there was so much demand on the state grant program. They're only allowed to do that in the biennium. And so as they move forward and do projections for 27, all of those levers go back to normal, go back to zero. And so what they're saying is, short of them having to pull those levers again, which are allowed in law, if they just go with the standard that's in there, that's the deficit that we're looking at. Does that make sense, Representative Robbins?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So it's really just about resetting because of the statute. It's not that there could continue to be a deficit in the state grant program, which would continue to create problems in the North Star program, but we're just following statute in the reset, which is why it shows a positive balance. But that, if we don't solve the deficit this biennium, it's probably going to be in deficit, correct?
Representative Robbins, I believe that the deficit will continue. I'm going to go to Commissioner Olson. I think he's tracking us now.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Robbins, it's hard to kind of see these in different snapshots in time. You know, as Ms. Schneider noted, these are projections and are based in kind of our only, you know, ability to look at the parameters in current law, to the chair's point. You know, what the governor's proposal does is adjust those parameters such that we end up staying or keeping spending within available resources. And so those rationing parameters are essentially proposed by the governor to balance the state grant, which will then, you know, impact the North Star Promise program and balance it as well. But we're looking at basically a snapshot, you know, with projection available, because we can't assume that governor's recommendations will be adopted or assume other adjustments to the parameters, you know, made by the legislature will go into effect.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. Also, I would note that I don't think there was an expectation of a 7% increase across the board, or as we heard, a 10,000 person increase at the University of Minnesota. Not all of them would be state grant eligible, but there was a significant increase there that wasn't considered in the forecasting because it wasn't reported to OHE. You remember that slide that we had? So there are a lot of parameters that we have to kind of manage. And so let me ask you, Commissioner Olson, if we didn't do the governor's levers in statute and you didn't have to ration, I think we talked about this before, that if we made folks whole from what they kind of had lost in the state grant program and moving forward, I think we had added up, it was like $230 or so million dollars in a deficit. Can you just speak to that? And maybe you're not tracking with what I'm saying, but we're just trying to figure out what is the hole that we're trying to backfill. Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, to your question, I believe we had presented it in part two. That fiscal 27 or total biennial number was, I believe, 133. So we did have a small projected spending balance in 26. But as Ms. Schneider noted, you know, when the parameters revert to current law in 27, you know, the ASR is adjusted back up to 50%. I believe it's 133. I can't, Madam Chair, remember the exact number, but 133. Point something million in 27. 133,854.
Good memory, Commissioner.
I had a phone a friend here. Cheat sheet.
Wonderful. Any other questions from members at this point? Okay, seeing none, if you would continue, Ms. Schneider.
All right. So as we try to be good stewards of the state resources, so when there's a strain, we focus on what's within our control and what's out of our control as a state agency. Also, it's a good time that we also have one semester of actual spending under our belt for North Star Promise, which gives us the opportunity to look back at implementation of the program to identify areas where we can adapt for sustainability purposes. So areas where we have some flexibility, we have some ability to transfer funds between our financial aid programs. We can set the North Star Promise Plus match percent up to 50% based on the availability of funds. As I mentioned, for fiscal year 25, it's set at 15%, and we anticipate it being set to 0% for the next two fiscal years. We can take some learning from the first year of implementation and adapt some of the guidance to our institution partners on what mandatory fees includes for the North Star program. And we can review guidance on which courses are considered when making payments for the North Star Promise program. Then there are some things that we don't have the flexibility to do as a state agency. So there is not a special revenue account for all of our aid programs. North Star Promise program has one. So any spending left at the end of the biennium, which is sometimes difficult to predict when we get down to the wire, we don't convert to a special revenue account. We either try to get the money out to students or we transfer it, but if we don't do this on time, we're required to return it to the general fund. We do our best to set the parameters so that we can get as much money out to our students as possible. We can't change North Star Promise program to cover anything other than resident tuition and fees. And we do not currently have funding transfer language around the North Star Promise funds. And we do have a little more flexibility to transfer money into the state grant program, and we can pull from a future state grant year in a biennium within the program like we did for fiscal year 24. Also, as noted, we do not play a role in estimating tuition and fee and enrollment changes. These come from our higher ed partners. And we don't have a role in any federal financial aid decisions or parameters such as Pell Awards, changes to the federal needs analysis due to the FAFSA Simplification Act. And as I mentioned in our last presentation 2 weeks ago, there's a predicted $2.7 billion shortfall for the federal Pell Grant program by the end of fiscal year 25, and a projected $71 to $111 million shortfall over the next 10 years. And because we don't know how Congress will address this shortfall, it makes it difficult for us to model the cost of the impact for Minnesota's financial aid programs when the Pell Grant changes. So I know we covered a lot 2 weeks ago on the state grant program, and then today we covered North Star Promise. So it feels appropriate to end our presentation by providing a few key takeaways. First, our financial aid programs and efforts to increase access to higher education are working, as evidenced by the increase of 18,000 undergraduate students enrolled in higher ed in Minnesota between fall of 23 and fall of 24, making Minnesota the fifth nationwide in enrollment growth during this time period. Second, we're in an environment of rising tuition and fees, along with record enrollment, and especially record enrollment among financial aid eligible populations, and then technical changes and budget strains at the federal level. So together, all these factors drive up demand and cost for state financial aid programs. So I want to end the presentation by thanking you for the opportunity to assist Minnesota students in gaining access to the resources they need to pursue and complete a higher education credential in Minnesota.
Thank you. Commissioner Olson, do you have anything to wrap up? And then I'll open it up to member questions.
Madam Chair, no, not at this time. Happy to take questions.
Fantastic. Chair Wilgamott.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Chair. And thank you for the third installment of your thoughtful presentations. I just wanted to follow up, and maybe we did have this in previous presentations, so if we didn't, you wouldn't mind repeating it. I appreciate on the final slide saying that the financial aid program's efforts to increase access to higher education are working. Could you just please either remind us or tell us just kind of some specifics on that? And I guess I'd ask that in general, and then even more specifically, I'm curious to know if you have any insights going to the slide where you have the information on the total number of students awarded North Star Promise, North Star Promise Plus. If we think, if those numbers have had any impact on enrollment, are those new students that are getting a college education because of these programs? Are these going to existing students that were already enrolled but are now eligible for this? If you have any insights on what the North Star Promise and North Star Promise Plus awards have done for enrollment.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Co-Chair Wolgamont, a lot in the question there. I'll try to hopefully answer a few pieces and things I maybe don't cover. Ms. Schneider can pick up. Yeah, just in terms of, you know, again, reiterating the numbers, you know, Ms. Schneider noted that we are, you know, fifth in the nation in terms of, you know, new undergraduate enrollment. Our headcount went from 238,000 students statewide to 256,000 statewide. And, you know, the national average was about a 4.5% increase. Midwest average was about 3.5%. And in Minnesota, we saw 7.4% increase overall. You know, and that was kind of across the board within all of our sectors, 4.2% in Minnesota private nonprofits, our public 4 years, 4.8%, public 2 years, 11.5%. You know, huge growth in our open access institutions. We don't yet, I believe, have enough information. You know, Ms. Schneider noted we're waiting on a full year of data to start to really analyze the impact of North Star Promise, and frankly, it may take us even a couple years to understand that correlation of, you know, increased enrollment and, you know, the potential influence or impact of North Star Promise. But we assume, it did drive some, you know, some enrollment choices and some choices whether to enroll as a recent high school graduate, a new freshman, or, you know, frankly, we've seen a significant increase in the number of adult students as well coming back to, you know, either reskill or upskill or finish a degree they maybe had to set aside due to life circumstances or other, yeah.
Representative Wolgamott, Chair Wolgamott.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer, Commissioner. That's exactly what I was looking for. Now I want to ask about, you know, as we're looking towards the future, looking to set our budget, what would be the cost or what would be the impact of taking money out of the North Star Promise appropriation and using it for other things? So can you share for us what would be the impact on these goals to increase enrollment? Can you speak at all for sort of what that would look like for our enrollment and our goals if we were to take money away from North Star Promise?
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont. I would just note that it's a special revenue account and we can't do that. We shouldn't do that, but Commissioner?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Wolgamont, I guess from the seat I sit in, that's not something I would recommend at all. One, because it is a new program, and, you know, again, we need to give it a little time to, you know, understand the impacts. Again, you know, we assume there's been some, you know, some positive movement here because of implementation of the program. You know, we've run some analysis, too, because, you know, we have fielded questions about, you know, whether we take potential resources from North Star Promise and, you know, utilize them for the state grant or for other specialized financial aid programs. You know, even doing that, we still would be in, you know, in a tough spot with the state grant program. And so, you know, at this point in time, it's advisable to leave it alone because, you know, frankly, we believe in it. And more than that, I would say students are now depending on it. You know, if we're really committed to our workforce goals, if we're really committed to the overall economic vitality of the state, you know, this is the program that seems to be driving that activity.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Scott. Representative Scott.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just whispering words of wisdom to my neighbor here.
We always encourage words of wisdom, Representative Scott.
So I noticed that enrollment went up 18,000 students approximately. And I know there's going to be some overlap here, but the North Star Promise had 14,516 students. Oh, Oh, this is the updated. Okay, sorry, updated, 15,146. So do we know how many of these North Star Promise students were first-time college students that have been previously enrolled, or how many of them weren't enrolled before? And just,
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. At this time, we don't have that specific breakdown. Something certainly we could take back and dig into the data about and get as specific as we can, again, with an understanding that we don't even have a full year of data yet.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think that would be helpful. I've got to think that the bulk of that 15,146 students are first time to college. And so in my mind, that would explain the 18,000 increase in enrollment. I mean, at least the majority of it in my mind, but I could be wrong. So you can prove me wrong, maybe.
Okay, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, so as we look at these two programs, I think they both serve important needs, and I think they serve a little bit different needs also. So with the North Star Promise Program, I mean, what I'm hearing you say, and I just need you to correct me if I'm wrong, is that since we started the North Star Program, we have had this increased enrollment, and it's traditionally from students who might not have known or thought that they were going to be able to attend college. Is that correct?
Commissioner Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne. I would say it's one of the factors. I mean, we are thankful that the legislature incorporated, additional administrative funds in the first year to really, allow us to work closely with both public systems to effectively advertise and, frankly, market this. I will say overall, I mean, response was incredible, whether it be through social media campaign or, other assets. You may have seen our presence at the state fair and, other college fairs where we're able to table at. But, what tells me that was effective was the response by systems within other neighboring states and within other systems as well. Seeing a couple of our private nonprofits, kind of mirror similar eligibility criteria for their own institutional funds or partnerships with other philanthropic entities. And then, of course, news about North Dakota institutions, looking to attract Minnesota students in the same way by making the same promise, although not having the opportunity to, have it have a long-term appropriation. It was at the time a one-year commitment. It does seem like it's been effective and has driven that activity, certainly.
Okay. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. Just one last follow-up. So flattery is, often by imitation, right? So when you do something well, other people will take that on. So I will say that I compliment you on creating a good program together with the legislature that other states and colleges want to emulate. But Minnesota has had the public institutions have had an increase in student supply. And then the private colleges also, I think, and I saw in your report that they also had an uptake in their enrollment. Is that correct?
Commissioner Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne, that is correct.
Representative Cleburne.
So with that, right, then it's a mixed blessing, right? So we have these additional students in both the private colleges, which costs us more in-state grant, potentially, and then we have the North Star program that's attracting more students, which also costs us money in-state grant and in North Star, right? So we have charged you with a goal of a certain percentage of people attending college. And it feels like now we're trying to figure out how do we help you attain that goal and try to figure out how to keep these programs viable. So I just want to thank you for your continued partnership and for making sure that we have the data that we need to help drive these decisions and for the cooperation that your office has with all of us to make sure that we're making the right decisions. Thank you.
Any other member comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, I'll give the commissioner and your staff the last word.
Madam Chair, and members, just again, reiterate what I opened with. You know, thank you once again for the opportunity to bring this information forth. And, you know, I know at times it is, you know, a little tough to hear news that a lot of our, or I should say all of our state financial aid programs to a degree are feeling some pressure, but it is a good story, you know. And I get to a few of the member questions, this is the result, you know, we were looking for by making these investments. And, you know, our hope is that we can continue to build and fulfill our commitment and promise to our students that, you know, we're going to take care of them here in Minnesota because we want them here. We want them to stay and raise a family and, of course, you know, contribute to Minnesota's economy. So thank you for the opportunity to deliver that information.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. We certainly do. We want an educated workforce, and I know that the employers are looking for employees like crazy. So we're hoping to train up as many as we can and to stay in Minnesota. I know that that is something really important to all of us as well. Thank you, Commissioner Olson, and your team. I appreciate you. And I'm sure we'll be in close contact as we move into budget negotiations. Some of the most interesting I think this body has ever seen.
Thank you, Madam
Thank you, Commissioner. With that, we're going to skip ahead a little bit in our agenda and call up Hennepin Healthcare. And as they come up, they unfortunately were the, I'll say the recipients of our great interest in things in higher ed, and they only got 10 minutes to present. And they would let, I'm asking them to come back to go through the financial part of it just a little differently. We didn't get a whole lot of time to do that before, and what the work they do is incredibly important. So I've asked them to come back, and I believe they also have some new people with them. So I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce yourself again to the group, Dr. Walsh, and see who you brought with this time. I see you have a gentleman that I got to talk to over Zoom, and so I'm very grateful that he is here because we speak the same language. So I'm glad you brought him. Dr. Walsh, please introduce yourself to us, and you can pull up your slide presentation.
Thanks. Thanks, Chair Rarick. I'm Dr. Megan Walsh. I'm the Chief Academic and Research Officer at Hennepin Healthcare and also an internal medicine physician. In my role, I oversee physician education ranging from medical students through residents and fellows and on to faculty needing continued education for licensure.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Yes, Madam Chair. Charles Essler, VP of Finance here at HHS at Hennepin Healthcare, and pleased to support Dr. Walsh here and answer the questions of the committee and what you may have.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for both for being here. Dr. Walsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to begin by expressing my sincere gratitude for the annual appropriation of $645,000, or $1.29 million per biennium, designated to support family medicine residency training in Minnesota. I'm here again today to offer further detail regarding the critical value of this funding, how it's used, and the impact it has on our healthcare system and our communities across Minnesota. Our family medicine residency program is based at the Whittier Clinic, that's the photo here in my slide, in South Minneapolis, and also at Hennepin County Medical Center, Minnesota's flagship public teaching hospital in downtown Minneapolis. This is one of the oldest accredited family medicine programs in the state. Since its founding in 1970, we have been committed to training comprehensive, community-focused physicians prepared to meet the diverse needs of patients and families throughout our state. Each year, we welcome 11 new residents into our three-year residency program, maintaining a full cohort of 33 residents. Just last Friday, we successfully matched another talented class of incoming interns, selected from a pool of over 1,200 applicants. The high volume and caliber of applicants reflect both the reputation of our program and the urgent demand for well-trained family physicians. Family medicine training at Hennepin spans every corner of care, from outpatient clinic to inpatient wards, the ICU to the emergency department, from labor and delivery to nursing homes. Our residents deliver babies, care for the elderly, treat chronic disease, and manage complex acute care conditions. They are trained to care for everyone from newborns to aging adults, making them the Swiss Army knives of physicians. The training is not theoretical. Teaching residents requires real-time hands-on instruction, whether at 2 a.m., assisting in a delivery, demonstrating how to suture a wound in the emergency department, or navigating delicate end-of-life conversations with families. Teaching residents in family medicine is a 24/7 commitment by our dedicated faculty who embody Hennepin's 100-year legacy of service and education. The appropriation from the Office of Higher Education is specifically used to support the teaching portion of residency. It pays faculty who are in the room, on the floor, and at the bedside, training our next generation of primary care providers. Without this funding, we would be forced to reduce the number of residents we train. More specifically, a loss of $645,000 would require us to eliminate nearly 4 residency positions per year. This is a devastating impact not only on our program, but on the communities that these future doctors go on to serve. You asked for clarity on the financials. This slide highlights the specifics in how we are utilizing this appropriation, more specifically to the program leadership of the residency, which is an accreditation requirement, whether you are a Hennepin Family Medicine residency or a Mayo Family Medicine residency or a Harvard Family Medicine residency. Program directors, associate program directors, and core faculty are dictated by accreditation requirements, and we abide by those, and this is how we utilize this precious funding. I provided this slide last time, and a good, healthy conversation with Chair Rarick, we were able to really come to a shared enlightenment about a better way to present this data that would make more sense. So I have kept the old slide but brought in the new one specifically so that you could peel back the curtain and see how each dollar goes into medical education training specifically for family medicine. So on the right graphic lists, it itemizes all of the annual expenses for a single resident to train in family medicine, from their stipend, their associated faculty costs, the benefits, food, the accreditation for our programs to stay viable. Indirect costs are the costs to keep the lights on, the heat on, et cetera, books, education, and the leadership we spoke about. In family medicine at Hennepin, the total cost per year for a single resident to train is approximately $188,000. I also wanted to be very clear about revenues that come in for medical education training. CMS, the federal government, provides a direct medical education benefit for residents. This direct benefit does not even cover the salary of a single resident. We also receive some state funding in MERC funding, which is listed here for a single resident, and the family medicine appropriation per resident from this committee approximates $19,000 per resident. The total revenue per family medicine FTE is $101,000, roughly $600. So in red on the left, this leads to an annual shortfall year over year of approximately $86,000 of a financial gap or shortfall per resident in family medicine per year. Let me be clear about what this program delivers for Minnesota. Over 550 family medicine physicians have been trained in our program since we began. The vast majority have entered long-term primary care practice. These residents don't go into family medicine for a year. We survey, and they're in 10 or more years just in the surveys we've done in the last two decades. The vast majority, over 50%, remain in Minnesota, serving urban and rural communities across the state. At a time when the Minnesota Department of Health reports an impending wave of retirement and workforce attrition among healthcare providers, especially in rural and underserved areas, this residency program is not just a training site. It is a workforce pipeline. It is a long-term investment in the health and stability of our communities. Thank you again for this continued support. I urge you to maintain this critical appropriation and help ensure that Hennepin and Minnesota can continue to train the physicians we so urgently need.
Thank you, Dr. Walsh. I appreciate you coming back, and I appreciate the conversation that we had, and I wanted the whole committee to hear a little bit simpler version and I'm sure there's a couple on the committee that are in health that probably knew what the acronyms are and were, my question is, you have an annual shortfall of about $82,000 per year per resident, and how is that covered, Dr. Walsh?
Do you want to speak to that? How our annual shortfall is covered?
Madam Chair, do you mind?
Mr. Eisler.
Thank you. It is well, unfortunately, last few years, our financials overall are in a lost position, if anybody's seen that. I believe the audited statements are included in some of the materials today. It is spread across the rest of the house. So the organization is a healthcare entity, covers all these costs, but a lot of our costs are not covered, which is why every dollar matters to the overall financial results.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, I think this is a very important program. Obviously, I'm a big supporter of funding medical education, and I fully understand that it's a really expensive venture and how critical it is that we do this kind of training in the state. But in your table here, I don't see anything about what the resident actually brings in billings. And I know that obviously they're not able to do what a physician who's out of their training can do, but there is that aspect of it too. So could you talk about that a little bit? Are you able to bill for their services? I'm not sure how it works at HCMC, but or in this clinic, but I think that's an ingredient here too.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Dr. Walsh?
Thank you for the question, Representative Liebling. Yes, residents do function in a clinical delivery space, seeing patients. All of the billable time goes up through the faculty member. So there is no independent revenue that is brought in clinically for the residents' time, solely the faculty time. And, you know, take a faculty member who's at the bedside with a family medicine resident admitting their first patient. The faculty alone would admit that patient probably in about 20 minutes. A faculty with a brand new family medicine resident, it could take up to 2 hours to really admit a patient. So it is a slow down across all avenues of clinical care in the clinic, on the inpatient side, in the emergency department. And so there is some increased access due to many humans that can see patients, which is wonderful for the Whittier Clinic. The billings are all just faculty, rolled up faculty billings.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you for that. And so when you are talking about in this graph, or table, you had the faculty cost. So is the faculty cost there kind of accounting for that loss of clinical time when it takes 2 hours instead of 15 minutes, say? You're not able to, that faculty member is not able to bill their service for the 2 hours, clearly. So is that kind of where you're getting that faculty cost number from?
Dr. Walsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, the faculty cost is a direct cost of salary time. So we buy out clinical FTE for the faculty to teach. So yes, it does incorporate some of that, but it is not a dollar for dollar.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you.
Yeah. Aren't you glad we're doing this? Because I really felt like when they were here last time, we just didn't give them the proper time. 10 minutes just isn't enough to really understand the program, appreciate it, understand the financials. So I had a lovely time with them talking over Zoom, and I felt like the whole team really need, because this is not a me decision, this is a we decision. The whole team needed to hear the fullness, and we didn't have the time because we were really engaged in the previous presentation. So thank you, Representative Liebling. Any other questions? Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just trying to reconcile a few numbers here. So on one side, you say there are approximately 11 residents per, or it says 11 residents per class, 33 residents total. And then on another side, it says over 550 family physicians graduates overall. What is that number? What does that 550 number represent?
Dr. Walsh.
Thank you for the question. The program has been accredited since 1970. Every year we graduate between 9 and 11 residents over multiple decades.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's Madam Chair.
Representative Coulter.
So that number would include everybody who's graduated from the since before. Okay. I was like 11 times 13 does not equal 550. So I was just a little bit confused about that. Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you.
Good questions, Representative Coulter. I had the exact same question, especially since we looked at the year that it started. I think it said 12 or 14. I'm trying to find.
the year that we started giving the appropriation was much later than that. So I appreciate the question. And, well, we are really astute today. Like, we're really paying attention. So thank you, Representative Coulter, Representative Liebling.
And, Madam Chair, and this isn't anything about being astute, but I have to, I just want to make a comment because in the Health Committee, and generally, as I've seen over the years, there are these trends happening where a lot of different professions want to expand their scopes of practice and do a lot of things that traditionally physicians have done. And I always have a lot of concern about that. I tend to be someone who pushes back on that a lot because I think it's important to appreciate here, we have this moment to appreciate here kind of what it takes to train a physician and what that really means. And especially as we start to say in a lot of other venues, you know, we need more practitioners. We need more practitioners. So let's kind of take different people with different, much less training and put them out in some places and let them provide care for Minnesotans. And it's really hard to strike the right balance on that because clearly it's really hard and really expensive to get the highly, highly trained physicians. But we desperately need them. I mean, Minnesota is known for having a really high quality of care here. And I really worry that if we don't invest in really this intensive, high-level training, and instead we kind of go to the, you know, let's open the, reduce the barriers and let more practitioners get out there and deliver those babies and provide that primary care because we've got shortages. I mean, there's a role for some of that too, but we've got to have this or we're going to, you know, this is like over time we're going to be a very different place and we will lose our reputation and our reality of being a state where we have really excellent care available for people. So I just had to make that comment because it's kind of all happening right now in other committees. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. So that's all incredibly important. And I wanted to hear the committee's thoughts too, because honestly, the 10 minutes wasn't enough for them to really do the presentation. And that's exactly what I wanted to hear is the importance and what the committee heard and what the committee would like, because I always feel like this isn't a me decision in the budget. This is a we decision. I wanted to hear all the voices and know what everyone values. And so that's incredibly important for me to hear. So thank you for saying that. And I greatly appreciate that input. Any other member questions or comments? Well, we have them here. Okay, you've done a fantastic job. Thank you for coming back. Thank you for taking it out of the hospital vernacular and put it in vernacular that we understand. And thank you for bringing Mr. Eisler back too, because I know he speaks accounting so we can talk the same language. So thank you so much for coming back. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Okay. We have CentraCare, and I'm not sure if they have made it back yet. So about 10 minutes. Committee, we've got CentraCare on their way to do kind of a walkthrough of the $10 million that we gave them, and I'm assuming that Chair Wolgamott would like to hear how they spent the $10 million. They are about 5 to 10 minutes out as they're coming down, I'm sure, from St. Cloud. If the committee would allow, I'm going to just go into a brief. Oh, go ahead, Representative Hansen.
Just if I might just use this time while we wait for a second.
Sure.
I made a comment in my presentation the other day, and I just wanted to make sure my committee members were aware. I had mentioned something about the Minsky pay system, and I was like so grateful that everything was fixed, and then a bunch of people told me it's not fixed. Mm-hmm. So there are still issues persisting, and I think it's important for this committee to know that, and I felt bad for giving you wrong information, so I just wanted to correct that. So I thought we'd use that time for that. Thank you, Chair.
That is a fantastic use of time. Thank you for bringing that on the record. And before we go into a brief recess, so back to Representative Scott's question about being absent or present. And we actually looked through the video quickly of those 2 days, and I think you were sick those 2 days. I don't know if you recall being sick those 2 days. So I believe you were actually absent those 2 days, but we actually did look through all of the video quickly, just
on the side. And I think we checked in with, check this one. Okay. So we'll figure that out as well, since we did just pass them with moving you from absent to present. So maybe I'll look at, since we've got a couple minutes till the next presenter comes in, I'll look to our nonpartisan folks of, now that we've adopted minutes again and we need to maybe unadopt them again. Mr. Hopkins, do you have a suggestion?
Madam Chair, if we can get revised minutes, we would do the same thing we did today, reconsider the minutes that were adopted that were incorrect and substitute them with the revised corrected minutes when we have those.
Okay.
My apologies, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott, I always defer to the member that you remember well, and your calendar is correct, and so I always defer the member, but we did actually look through the video evidence, and it did substantiate what you thought. But what we'll do then is we'll amend those for the next time, and we'll do that one more time. Yes, Representative Cleburne.
This question really goes to Mr. Hopkins.
Sure.
Mr. Hopkins, is it possible for us to make a motion that we give permission to the committee legislative assistant to review the video and make the necessary changes?
Mr. Hopkins.
Well, Representative Cleburne, I was just speaking with the committee administrator, and the minutes that we have actually are correct if they reflect that Representative Scott was absent. So I guess we can, and we did not adopt the minutes yet, so we can finalize the motion to reconsider the previously adopted minutes and adopt the packet of new minutes, which are all correct.
Awesome.
Wow, okay, that is quite a motion. Okay, so we're gonna do that, and so we're all done. Let me just go back to the dates. It was February 25th and 27th. And so, Mr. Hopkins, would you restate the motion that I will be making?
Madam Chair, so it would be to move to reconsider the adoption of the minutes of February 25th and 27th, and then you would move to adopt these corrected minutes for February 25th and 27th.
It's not as complicated as I had it in my head. Okay. So I will make a motion to reconsider the minutes from February 25th and 27th. Okay. All in favor of the reconsideration, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. All right. Those 2 minutes are before us. And so now I would like to make a motion to adopt the minutes as they were written in your packets. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The new packet of minutes are adopted as written. Now we're done. It's always fun. It's a fun day in the Higher Ed Committee. All right. Any other business before we have our presenters in about 5 minutes? Any other thoughts or concerns about budget as we go into that? In fact, if you've got high priority things, if you want to just tell me that on the record, we could do that as well. Otherwise, we'll go into a brief recess until our testifiers come. Okay. Seeing no takers on that, we will go into a brief recess. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Okay.
It's all done.
Yep. I remember that for one day. Hello.
No, we told you 215.
Okay,
so that is, we understand 100%.
Okay, we were actually picked him up in Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't know what the. Okay, yep, so talk to Zoom.
Yes, Jesse, Jill.
Yep, okay, thank you. Yep, sorry about the confusion. We thought the one presentation was going to go much longer because this is really complicated.
Hundreds of millions.
I'm just like, where are you, Michael? I can see the Capitol and the parking lot.
Okay.
I just don't even do it publicly.
Well, that was fun.
Over Monticello.
On deck.
From Monticello?
Yeah, they came from Monticello. Because we have a center care center also in Monticello.
You just hitched a ride with me this morning.
Were you in Monticello? Oh, just from Buffalo, yeah.
Yeah. It's a very nice drive, except on Wednesdays.
Why is Wednesdays bad?
That's the most congested. Because you usually Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are not work from home days for a lot of downtown.
Oh.
So then it just gets back. Usually around Maple Grove.
How fun.
Minutes.
So minutes as written are correct. And thank you for reviewing that so we can just get it done. Do I need to sign?
I think the new ones will have to be signs because I have to scan them for a record.
Okay,
but
right.
I can bring them back and then just set them here.
Is this probably the correct packet, right?
Oh, yes, that's the correct.
So yep. I could sign this one and then you're done?
And then, yeah, I can take it with me and I'll scan them all and send it to them. I think the confusion was because she got chair this year and it was in the morning, but she was sick, so she did stay in her office, because I remember that.
Yep, I remember that now, too.
The, she wasn't there for the 2 days that were coming in.
So these, only, so this is the...
The joint one?
The joint.
So, since they did it there, the only ones that were signed.
Oh, fabulous. Perfect.
That's why I wanted both of us together to do a separate set of minutes so that both of you had a signature on there.
I don't care. Yeah, that's fine. I'm just trying to make sure I'm signing what I need to sign.
Thank you.
Yes. So technically, we're really just iterating with like stopping.
Thank you. Sorry we're late.
I will call the meeting back to order. We now have our presenters from CenterCare. If you want to come up to the testifiers table, welcome to the committee. Bless you, Chair Wolgamott. Welcome, CenterCare and team. If you want to introduce yourself to the committee, and welcome back again. And we look forward to your presentation of the use of the $10 million. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Mike Blair. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Senior Vice President of Academic Affairs for CenterCare. And I will let Andy Smart here introduce herself for the record.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Andy Smart. I'm the Vice President of Finance and Treasury for CenterCare. Thank you for having us.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Blair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for inviting us back to speak about the $10 million grant. And thank you for your patience. We had a board meeting this morning and drove down from St. Cloud. So appreciate you taking a break there before we got started. Great. Thank you. Do we have slides for the...
They have them printed out.
You have printed? Okay. I just wanted to make sure everybody had copies of the slides. So excellent. Thank you. So I will start with the introduction here, and then I will have Andy take over with a little more detail. But I thought what would be helpful to start with, and that's on the first slide here when we talk about the why for our community. I think it's always, you know, good for us just to take a moment to level set and anchor ourselves in why we're doing this work. And then, of course, we'll move into more details around the spending on the $10 million grant. But as we've talked about at the previous meetings and when we were here a couple years ago, we're really trying to solve the issues with access in rural Minnesota for physicians. And there's some really some sobering statistics as we look across the country, and that is, if we look across all the United States, like 20% of U.S. residents live in rural areas. And yet only 11% of physicians practice in those same areas. And what's really sobering is of incoming medical students, only 4% are coming from rural areas. And there's a clear correlation to where an individual grew up who goes through medical school and then to the residency program, where they will go on to practice. So we already have access issues in rural Minnesota. And if we don't solve this, it's going to get worse. A few other statistics. Minnesota Department of Health every year does a survey of physicians practicing in rural Minnesota. Median age is 58. That's actually been updated now. It's 60. And one-third of those physicians have indicated that they're going to leave the practice within 5 years. So as I mentioned earlier, we already have access issues in rural Minnesota. And unless something gets done here, this is going to, you know, get worse. So there's clearly a public need here. And we have a saying at CenterCare, and when we engaged with our partners at the University of Minnesota, that saying was, if not us, then who's going to solve this public need? And if we don't get started now, then when are we going to get started? So this is really focused around how could CenterCare, how could the University of Minnesota Medical School come together to do something that neither one could do together to really address a public good? And so I really, want to thank this committee. The $10 million funding, which we're going to go through in detail here, has really been helpful for us to get this up and going. And as you can see on your next slide, which talks about the tripartite mission, this is really bigger than just a medical school. What we're talking about is, one, we need to create a medical school that's focused around physicians who want to go on and practice in rural areas. And that's what we're opening this fall. But once they're done with medical school, they have to train. You know, many of you or all of you probably know this. You know, the residency programs are typically 3 to 7 years, right? And so if we want them to stay and practice in rural Minnesota, not only do we want to educate them there, we want to train them there. And then they're most likely to stay. And one thing I think is important for the committee to know, we're really focused around getting physicians educated at our medical school, doing training. We hope they work for CenterCare, but if they want to work for anywhere else in rural Minnesota, We're happy. If they want to go work at Elmer in Alexandria, Glacial Ridge down in Glenwood, or up in the Northwest, we're okay with that. We just want them to stay and practice in rural Minnesota, because we touched Minnesota, because we talked about it. That's where we have a real access issue. So that's a bit of the background. What you hear when I turn it over here to Andy Smart is our first approach is, you know, get the medical school up and going. At the same time, we're trying to get the residency programs, and we talked a little bit about that last time we were here, get the residency programs moving. And the other is we really want to create research that's focused around how do we better the health of rural Minnesota residents. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Andy to talk through the grant, how we're spending money to the grant, and what our plans are for the funding.
Thank you. Ms. Smart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mike. So I'm going to go through a very focused update on the $10 million state grant appropriation. I do want to do a little bit of context setting before I get into the details of the numbers. So on the next slide, we've got the language, of course, of the appropriation, which I'm sure you're all very familiar with. But I just wanted to point out that there are four key guidelines that the funds were to be utilized for. So first was tuition support. The second was the opening and the operations of the new campus at St. Cloud, residency expansion, and then the starting and an opening of a rural health research program. So once we received the final language on this law and the funds were delivered, we established a finance subcommittee, Rural Health Academic Affiliation Finance Subcommittee, very long title. But we set this up so that we could appropriately manage the funds and make sure that we were spending them as intended. The grant does give us until June 30th of 2027 to spend the funds. And this was really important for us, and we were very appreciative to have this timeline, because as you open a med school, you have to bring in staff prior to having the full tuition load from the students to help offset the expenses of the staff and cost of running the med school. So this gives us the time that we need to get our full four-year load of students on board and have that full load of tuition flowing through the system. If we can move to the next slide, I'm not going to go through all of this detail of our guidelines that we have put in place for our operations in the Rural Health Finance Committee, but I want to point out a few things. The reason why we established this committee was to make sure that we could demonstrate risk mitigation and oversight of not only the $10 million funds that were given to us, but to the budget as a whole. We are a larger system in rural Minnesota, and we made sure that we were establishing the same type of controls for our academic affiliation that we use in our system. So we have expenditure control, we have conversations about FTEs, and we require multiple levels of approvals before we add to the structure. So both the budget for the medical school, our GME budget, our research budget, and the way these $10 million grant is being appropriated is all ran through this finance subcommittee. We do present all of our numbers as a combined budget, so you can see the total cost and investment of the academic affiliation, not just one side or the other. We feel like this is very important because we want to make sure we have transparency into the cost of opening a new med school and the decisions being made about the investments for that location. I do want to just call out a little bit on the governance. There's four members on the finance subcommittee, Mike Blair, Bill Siebert, Tammy Price, and myself. And the way we have ourselves structured, if we have a request to the budget to either be changed, Tammy and I meet and discuss if we can fit that into available funds. If we can't, then we take it to the finance subcommittee with the other two members. Any FTE changes, salary increases, FTE additions are required to go to the full committee for discussion, and we also require our CEO and the dean to provide approval for those additions as well. So we're putting these controls in place to make sure that we are appropriately utilizing the funds, that we're spending correctly, and we're maintaining consistency across the campuses of the med school. If we can go to the next page, before we started setting out the actual budget, we decided to work through our strategic priorities for how we were going to utilize the $10 million that were given to us. So we focused on, again, the four areas that the language gave us, and we drilled down into some specifics that we knew needed to be funded before the med school was fully open. So from the med school opening, we focused on the accreditation costs, promotional materials, and recruitment fees, the salaries of administration and faculty that we needed to bring on prior to the med school opening, and then startup costs and training costs for our preceptors. In our residency program, we focused again on those salaries and support costs that we needed to incur to get the residency programs up and running. Training costs, salaries and benefits of our residents that aren't covered by Merck or DME, and then some renovations that needed to occur to allow for room for the residents to be trained. We included scholarship funds that can't be covered by philanthropy. And then in the Research Institute, we also had salaries and support costs for bringing in the administration needed to stand the program up, dedicated resources from UMMS, and some consulting costs to ensure we were standing it up correctly. Now we can get into some details on the numbers. So I wanted to talk first about the detailed spending that has occurred to date, and then we'll talk about the planned spending for FY 26 and 27. And then I have a summary overview so you can see the whole picture of the $10 million grant. I want to remind everyone to the point earlier that we have until 2027 to utilize these funds. Our deficits for 24 and 25, which you see on the detailed spending to date page, have not been drawn from the grant yet. We will do that at the end of our fiscal 25, so we only do it once to reduce the administrative burden. So to get into some specifics, in 2024, we incurred $155,000 in startup costs for the medical school. This was largely based on technology that we needed to purchase and start standing up, and the administrative coordinator that we needed to bring on to start forming the med school. In 2025, we have $1.8 million in cost associated with the startup of the med school. This was largely based on the faculty that we began to onboard and train so that we could get the med school open. You can see the details on the far right-hand side of the FTEs specifically associated with the 2025 cost. We also had some incremental supply and administrative expenses associated with getting the med school up and running. So again, those two deficits that we've incurred, we'll wait until the 2025 numbers are finalized, which will be in June, and then we'll make our first request for disbursement in July of 2025. I'm happy to get into specifics on any of these numbers, but I wanted to make sure to go through it all first, and so you can see the full picture. So on the next slide, we have the detailed plan spending for 2026 and 2027. The main focus for these 2 years is the continued support of the opening of the med school as we continue to bring students in year by year and that tuition grows. We do have continued deficit funding needed. So the total planned spend in 2026 is $5.8 million. $533,000 of that will be related to scholarships that will be given to the students. That scholarship level is held consistent with scholarship awards at the other two campuses. We intend to offset the remaining amount of tuition by philanthropy, if possible. We'll have just under a $2.5 million deficit in the UME program, so in the operations of the medical school. Those details are on the right-hand side of the page. We'll incur $1.9 million in some renovation of our Lakeland Clinic in order to accommodate the residents that will need to be rotating through there. Currently, we don't have enough space for them to train in that location. And then we have $1 million for the startup of the research program, which will largely be based on salaries for the administrative and research programmatic staff needed to come on board and begin developing the programs. In 2027, our total expected spend from the $10 million grant will be $2.1 million. $1 million of that will be in scholarships again, for we'll have at that point 2 years of students. We'll have a $500,000 in UME programmatic deficit. I would point out that does not cover the full deficit. It's the available remaining funds in the $10 million grant. And then we have a $500,000, again, allocated to research to continue covering the salaries for the research program as it gets stood up. So on the last slide, you can see the summary of how the $10 million is spent across the 4 years that we have to spend the funds. We remain consistent within the four categories that were outlined in the law, with our scholarships totaling $1.6 million. Deficit for the med school startup, just under $5 million, the residency program support of $1.9 million, and then $1.5 million for the research institute. We are very appreciative for this support and the opportunity it gives us to move this initiative forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Smart. It looks like you have a couple people on Zoom. Did you want them to testify, or were they here for questions?
They're just here for questions.
Wonderful. Any questions from – do you have any other presentation, or is that the end?
That's the end. Thank
Perfect,
you.
Perfect, Mr. Boyd. Thank you. Any questions from members? Okay. Yes, Chair Wolgemont, I thought you might have something to say.
I'm sure you're totally shocked. I'm excited to speak on this, Madam Chair. Well, thank you for the presentation and for making the trip down from St. Cloud to present this information to our committee. We're very proud of this investment that the state has made in the St. Cloud Medical School, and it's great to get the update. Now that we've really gone through and taken a dive into this $10 million, can you elaborate on how the current request that you have that you were here to present with Representative Perryman's bill last week, what would be the difference, what impact would that have on this $10 million appropriation? Would it enable you to do more? Would it help the state get more bang for its buck? Just could you talk about that new request for ongoing funding, how that relates to this? What would be the benefits of getting that ongoing investment from the state? And then what would be the detriments, the cost of the state doing nothing?
Mr. Blair.
Yep, Chair Rarick and members, appreciate the question. You know, as we look forward, well, let me step back for a minute. When we look at the $10 million spending, that's really around how do we get this program up and running. It's like, how do you get the medical school up and running, largely because you're going to incur a lot of costs before we're actually going to generate tuition. And that's really the same situation with the research work, is we need to get the infrastructure in place before we start generating more research and start getting some reimbursement for those indirect costs. It's a similar story with the residency programs. A lot of the costs in the $10 billion are really around how do we grow those programs. And for example, and you heard some of this from us last week, you know, the Minnesota Department of Health did a survey of shortage specialties in rural Minnesota, and they were family medicine, internal medicine, general surgery, pediatrics, obstetrics, and psychiatry. So we are focused on opening up new programs in all of those areas to help address, you know, those specific shortage needs. But as we look forward and we look at the cost of all those programs, and we currently have 18 residents, we're looking to grow up to 72. And the magic number around the 72 is we're going to be graduating 24 students out of the new medical school every year. And if the average residency program is 3 years long, you can see that for us to make sure we have training slots for them, we're going to need to grow from 18 up to the 72. And as we spoke about earlier, the data is clear that if an individual, if they educate, and especially if they train in a rural area, they're more likely to stay in that rural area. And we can all see how that makes sense. If you get done with medical school and then you go on to your residency program and you're going to be there for 3 years or even up to 7 years and you get established in that health system, you get established in that community, a lot of times they're not willing to uproot and move back. And so the challenge we have is if we continue to graduate medical students and we tell them to go to the metro and hope that they'll come back, you know, in 3 to 7 years, the chance of that happening is not real high. And so when we look at the current bill,
we're looking at what it's going to take to fund those 72 residents, and the available funding that's out there. Dr. Roski, who's on the call here today, I'll tell you, has been scouring every federal program we can to see if we can get any federal funding. There's not a lot out there. All of you know that, know the issues around the caps around direct medical education. We're also looking at philanthropic sources as well. And so this is really about the viability as we go forward, because we're projecting that when we get up to the full 72, and that's not going to be for about 10 years, that the annual structural deficit in that program will be about $10 million. And so that's why we've come here. Now, it's going to grow, obviously, as we go from our current 18 up to the 72. That structural deficit will increase year after year. So what we brought forward was the proposal around the 2 years, the biannual at $1.5 million a year to fund that initial, you know, side of the, you know, of the residency slots that we're opening over the next 2 years. So I would just summarize it as saying the $10 million was really about how do we get all these programs up and going. And then the $1.5 million per year that we're here, that's really like how do we maintain the viability as we go forward.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Okay. Any other member comments or questions? Seeing none. Thank you so much for the presentation and the detail. I appreciate that very, very much. And I think if there's no other business before us, I don't see any, we are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.